Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and today we hit the top 10 of our favorite 100 films of all time. It's episode 91. I know you can't believe it. I can't believe it. John can't believe it. Nobody can believe it. How in the world did we get here? 91 episodes later, we're at our top 10, and we're talking tonight about Mulholland Drive from 2001 and Casablanca from 1942. Two movies that were on both of our lists. John says Casablanca will be his number one next time, but I still get to intro it because it's on my list higher than his because I didn't make a mistake. And Mulholland Drive, which comes in at 10 for John. It came in a little bit lower for me. This is a movie that has jumped around my rankings all the time, and I can't wait to talk about it tonight. And my my differing experiences with this movie as I've watched it throughout different parts of my life because – it is truly one of the weirdest movies ever made, but easy to follow, which people disagree with. And I can't wait to break it all down tonight. So Casablanca, Mulholland Drive, John, how was your rewatch of both of these gems?
Fantastic. Honestly, looking at the shows we have coming up in the next 9 weeks after this, this one might be my favorite two movies that we are talking about at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it coming up. Like, for me, it has to be 2001 and Lost in Translation, which is what we're doing next week. I don't really have a choice on that because I have them both so high. But this is just fun because this is the differences in filmmaking is over the course of 60 years, right? Like, you look at a movie like Casablanca, generally regarded as one of the greatest movies ever made, normally put up as 1, 2, or 3 in terms of American films ever made. Up there with just The Godfather and Citizen Kane. I know Vertigo has started to pop up here and there, but I feel like Vertigo is always kind of number 4. It's always kind of out there. Yeah. It'll have its random ranking at number 1, and then it kind of disappears into the background at number 4. But it's always those three, and Casablanca could come in at 1 or 2, generally comes in at 2 behind Kane. But I do find it so compelling to sit down and I watch these back to back. I double featured this. Yeah. I did Casablanca first and I watched Mulholland Drive. And you just see how, like, the art of film and the medium of film, how different it can be and just how meaningful those differences can be. Like, Casablanca is a masterpiece, but so is Mulholland Drive. They're just masterpieces in totally, totally, totally different ways. And I watching them back to back was a very bizarre experience.
I can only imagine. Which one did you start with?
I watched Casablanca first.
Yeah, I imagine the contrast is even more evident when you follow up Casablanca with Mulholland Drive.
It is, because you're watching like a movie that was made so much as a movie, and then you're watching a movie that was made so much as an experience. And it's funny to see those two very different approaches to filmmaking, but two styles that work incredibly.
Yeah. I mean, these are two highly revered films by just like everyone. Casablanca has to be one of the easiest films to have anyone watch. And Mulholland Drive is the exact opposite of that.
Yeah.
People who love film struggle watching Mulholland Drive sometimes.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Mulholland Drive because Casablanca is the classic here. So we're going to start with Mulholland Drive from 2001, David Lynch's movie. John, you get to intro it because it's your number 10. Let's hear it.
There is no way to start talking about David Lynch by saying, what is with this man? Like, it's the mind of David Lynch is such a fascinating subject because the works he produces are absolutely insane. And, like, I don't say that word lightly, but the products he puts forward, you just have to sit there. Like you said, it's an experience and you just have to let it come to you. And Mulholland Drive is no exception. If it were not for The Return, this would be David Lynch's magnum opus, in my opinion. This is the point where David Lynch just said, you know what? I've made somewhat weird stuff before, but now we're going all out weird. And you just have to come along for the ride.
And I think what's interesting with Mulholland Drive, because so I think Eraserhead is the most bizarre movie I've ever seen in my life. And I didn't like Eraserhead. That's the only David Lynch movie that I've seen that I do not enjoy. I still haven't seen Lost Highway. It's on my list, but I haven't seen it. Also, if you're a David Lynch fan, Criterion Collection, as of yesterday, finally released Inland Empire on Blu-ray, which is a huge deal because Inland Empire has been impossible to find for the last 15 years. I mean, even when John and I did it for this podcast, we had to sit down and watch it on some crappy YouTube stream, or you had to pay like $75 to buy a terrible DVD of it. Like, good on the Criterion Collection for doing that. They had a flash sale yesterday. I didn't buy anything because my wife would have killed me because I have like 60 Criterion movies that I haven't watched yet. So I got to get to those first. But Inland Empire will be being purchased. And I think what was happening with David Lynch's movies prior to this, right? Like, Twin Peaks is weird, but Twin Peaks is very grounded. The Elephant Man is weird, but it's weird in a stylized manner. And The Elephant Man is the most straightforward movie David Lynch has ever made until he ended up making The Straight Story, which is like, how does David Lynch make a G-rated Disney movie about a guy on a tractor? I mean, that's the only way David Lynch can make one of those, but he does it. Wild at Heart, still like a pretty easy to follow story. And I feel like Lost Highway was when it was like, okay, what is this guy doing? I haven't seen it. But that's generally where people start to say that is his weird, weird, weird one. And then he comes out with Mulholland Drive. And this was at a time, if you think about 2001, I think 2001 is, if not the greatest year for film, it's top five, hands down, because of the depth of 2001. 2001 is just incredible. You had the first Lord of the Rings, you had the Royal Tenenbaums, you had Amelie, and I'm just naming those three. I think that was also the year with Black Hawk Down. Then you have Mulholland Drive. If you go look at the Oscars for 2001, you're just going to sit there and go, wow, how did all of these movies come out? And then you're going to go, wow, how did A Beautiful Mind win Best Picture? It's the most egregious thing that's ever happened in the history of film. And I say that all the time. But In the Bedroom, I didn't even talk about that one. Sexy Beast is a great movie. Training Day. I mean, you just go down the Moulin Rouge. It's crazy. Monsters Ball, Gosford Park. Like, this year was nuts. But all of those movies, with the exception of Gosford Park, because Gosford Park is a Robert Altman movie. And if you haven't seen a Robert Altman movie, he loves to just put characters out and do things. He made Nashville. But all of those were very straightforward. Here's your story, here's your protagonist, here's your antagonist, and here's the thing that makes this movie unique. It's a very unique year for film because of the directors who were making those films. We're talking Ridley Scott, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, Wes Anderson, Peter Jackson, Todd Field, who just told us Tar was going to be his last movie. Like, you go down the line, and all of these people were making these movies. And then David Lynch came out with this movie that was so freaking out there because it didn't follow that same type of format as the other movies of the era. And I actually discovered this movie, I want to say it was 2009. It was my senior year of high school. And Peter Travers for Rolling Stone came out with his best movies of the decade. And I believe this was either number one or number two. And I said, what are you talking about? Like I hadn't seen Lynch at the time. Like, it was, you know, I was in high school. So like, Lynch was, you're 14, 15, 16. Lynch is who you go to. You go to the Coen brothers, you go to PTA, you go to Wes Anderson, you go to that type of stuff. So I said, okay, let me give this movie a try. I watched it four times in 3 days.
Oh my God.
I watched it four times in 3 days. I'm not joking. I sat down and watched it. And then I watched it again the next day, and we had a snow day, and it was a blizzard. And I had my friend walk from his house to my house to watch it with me while we were having a blizzard, and the power went out during the Club Silencio scene.
No.
Yeah, right after, so when she's looking at the blue box, the power went out. And then the next day, I watched it again with another group of friends. So I watched it four times in 3 days because we had snow days, so we weren't doing anything. Because in New Jersey, you have snow. I don't know what it's like in Vancouver, but New Jersey, if it snows a little bit, you're having snow days and you're going to have multiple days off. So,
yeah, that's the same here.
Okay, because we're just not prepared for it. But so I couldn't get enough. And what I think is interesting is this movie was ahead of its time. And the further away you got from it, the more you appreciated it. And the more now when I sit down and watch this movie, I'm like, it's a very easy movie to follow. It's not that hard of a movie to follow. It's different. It's weird. But once you know the nuances of the movie, I think it might be David Lynch's most straightforward movie other than The Elephant Man and A Straight Story. I think it's his third most straightforward movie.
Yeah, and I feel like it should be more accessible than it is. And people really cling on to the weirdness of it. But even rewatching it this time, it felt a lot easier to follow than it did the last time I watched it. And it does feel like that movie, the more times you watch it, the more you understand about it. But it also felt a lot shorter than I remembered it being, too. And, like, this isn't a short movie by any means, but it does not feel that long.
Yeah, I mean, it's a solid 2.5 hours. It's 2.5 hours long. And what I find fascinating about this movie is, and this is what I like about Lynch, and this is why I think Lynch always comes up. It makes you, when it's over, you question it. What was that about, right? We're talking about Space Odyssey next week, and we're talking about Lost in Translation. Lost in Translation is very much like Casablanca, right? Because Casablanca, at the end of the movie, what do you think is going to happen with Louis and Rick? I don't know. Will he ever see Ilsa again? We don't know. And Lost in Translation with Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson with the whisper in the ear was it's iconic. I mean, people are like, what did you say to her? But Space Odyssey, Mulholland Drive are very similar because it's, what is that movie about? What are they trying to say? What is this director trying to say? And watching it this time, and I've kind of had this thought before, but I really see it so clearly how Lynch wanted to make a movie about what a miserable, horrible place the film industry of Hollywood is. He did. Yeah. He wanted to make that movie. Yeah. But David Lynch didn't actually have all that bad of an experience in Hollywood. He was very successful from a young age. I mean, AFI gave him money to make Eraserhead. They would never do that nowadays with a movie like Eraserhead. And he had the success of Twin Peaks, even though obviously Twin Peaks, he fought a lot with the production and the network and everything like that. But he wanted to make that movie, but he wanted to make it his own way. And this is so real, right? Because the whole first 2 hours of this movie is a dream sequence. He lets you know that right away as soon as he zooms in on the pillow. It's a dream sequence. She is having her dying dream or her death dream, or you could just say she's having a dream before she goes on to kill herself. But that's what the whole first 2 hours of this movie is. It's this dream of what Hollywood is. Because when you aspire to be in Hollywood, most of your time is spent thinking about how amazing it's going to be. And then you get there and it's chaos and shit until you're done. And the last half hour of this movie, the extreme realism and the total shift and how all of it pieces together of what she was imagining and how she was experiencing it and why she was having this guilt and all of that. I mean, it's just flat out. It's flat out phenomenal. Like it's an amazing depiction of what you can do with the medium of film to tell a story and still have it work so clearly. Because right, everybody in the dream sequence is something different than they are in the real sequence, except for one character. And that's the cowboy. The cowboy is still like this mysterious guy who dresses up like a cowboy. And we don't actually know what his whole spiel is or anything in the real world, but he's the only character who's the same. Like everybody else is different. And he's the one who says, if you do bad, you're going to see me one more time. If you do good, you'll see me one more. If you do bad, you're going to see me two more. You see him two more times in the movie. I love what Lynch does with this. And I don't know if a movie has ever felt more like a dream when trying to depict a dream than Mulholland Drive.
And I think that's where Lynch really excels. Lynch is able to create a world that feels so much like our world, but something's just slightly off the entire time. And that's how he captures this dream. And there's so much talk about dreams in this movie, whether it be like Betty's aspirations or the Dan's dream about the Winkies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much talk about dreams in this movie that you have to be questioning whether or not anything you're seeing is happening the entire time. Mm-hmm. And he even presents it in a way where we're thrust into this world full of incredibly stereotypical characters. Like, yes, we have the outliers, like the cowboy, who's just this, like, mysterious character. But if you look at every other character in this movie, they are so cookie cutter and stereotypical. If we look at, like, Betty is so naive from the middle of nowhere Canada that she gets to her aunt's apartment and there's someone in there and she's like, oh yeah, this is totally cool.
Yeah.
And totally normal. Like, no one in their right mind thinks like that, especially not now, obviously.
But yeah.
even
I mean, in 2001 was ago. I think this released right after 9/11, so I don't think people were thinking that way either then.
Yeah, exactly. But then you look at, like, all these other characters, even like Justin Theroux's character is like that stereotypical, like, you know, artist who is being strangled by, you know, producers into making the movie that they want. And then even like things like Justin Theroux's wife sleeping with Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yeah.
And like, he's just like, his character of like Gene is just like this machismo man is like exactly who you expect you to go home and see your wife sleeping with. Right. Like, everything in this movie is so stereotypical that Lynch makes it seem completely out of left field.
Well, and okay. So what I really noticed this time is I agree with all that. Right. But they're all the stereotypes that you imagine. If you're having a dream about what Hollywood would be like, right? Like, that's what you're imagining. Mm-hmm. The overly ambitious director who's being shut down by the producers and stuff who are just pricks for no reason. They don't like their cappuccino. And he just walks out. Yeah. Like, it's the stuff like that. And I agree. Like, Lynch is going so overboard with these stereotypes in the dream. But the other thing that I really noticed, and it always, so this movie was my number 20 the first time I ever did a top 100. Now I have it at 58. And I don't know where I'll end up putting it because I love the last half hour so much. And every time I get to the last half hour, remember why I love the first 2 hours so much. Because the first 2 hours, I'm like, when you haven't watched in a little while, you're like, the pacing is weird. It's off. Like, they talk, like, there's so many weird pauses. It's awkward. It's all of that. But then in the last half hour, all of that's gone. Because it's no longer the dream. It's all of, now it's the real. This is the living world where things have to be more normal. So there has to be that contrast. And I love Mark Pellegrino's hitman scene. It's phenomenal because you get this like bumbling hitman and Lynch is having fun with it. He's poking fun at everything in Hollywood, all of the stereotypes, all the things you see in movies and TV shows and everything that people want, right? Like the director who's a billionaire, whose wife is cheating on him, and you know, the guy is the pool boy and he's this poor, rugged, whatever. And then you have, what do you call it? Like the super hot girl who's just being gifted a job because the mob wants her to have a job. And you go to the casting agent who's never going to get the picture made, but he's such a nice guy and it doesn't matter. Like, it's just never going to happen. Like, all of these characters are so stereotypical, but the reason that they all work is because Lynch is putting enough of a spin on them and letting you know the whole time, this is a dream, this is a dream, this is a dream, this is a dream. And by the time you get to the real versions of all these people, what you realize is it's all people she knows, but she's trying to make it in her dream. She is making it Hollywoodized. Mm-hmm. She is making it so that it's softer for her. It's not as cutting for her, that things are not going her way, that things are working out poorly for her. Like, all of these people in the dream world are caricatures of something that we see in movies and TV shows. And all of the people in the real world feel like real world versions of the characters we saw for the first 2 hours of the movie.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what is – that's so hard to do and still make it pay off and work.
Yeah, it is. And I think what's jarring about this film is – you are presented with these dark elements of the world, but everything that happens to Betty and Rita goes right. Everything is like fine for them, essentially, right? Everything is going their way. Betty goes to an audition and she nails it. And oh my God, Naomi Watts, absolutely spectacular. Like,
yeah, she's so good in this.
Oh my God, she's good in everything and she is so underrated, but she is so good in this movie. And you have that contrasted with people talking about like these deep, dark fears. And we're contrasted with like Michael J. Anderson's character, who's like this mob I don't know, like Bob Boss guy, who they definitely just gave him a fake body, right?
Yeah.
And it's so weird because you know exactly who this is because you're watching a Lynch movie, which means you've seen every other Lynch thing because that's how Lynch works. And it, like, it's this dark, seedy underbelly that doesn't quite make sense. And then you have, like, the winky scene. The winky scene is often considered one of the greatest jump scares in movie history. And it's such a phenomenal scene because it captures that essence of why dreams and what makes a dreamscape, essentially, right? That idea of, like, I know this, I've done this before, but everything feels, like, slightly off. And that's what, like you said, the entire first 2 hours of this movie is.
Well, and right, like he's saying, you're right over there. You're standing right there. And then when we see the scene later where she turns around and he's the one standing there. And why do we have the jump scare with that? A lot of people theorize that that's supposed to be the devil. It's the devil pulling her down, essentially, is the homeless man behind the Winkies with the blue box, who has the blue box at the end of the movie. People will theorize that that's actually like the devil living in Los Angeles, like pulling her under. But either way, that blue box, whatever that blue box is that it opens, because we have the blue key and you'll see this, and there's that box, which we know the box is in the real world and in the dream world. That blue box is in the possession of the homeless man. How did he get that? I don't know, but somehow Naomi Watts' character, whether you want to call her Betty or Diane Selwyn, saw that character at another point, and it scared the daylights out of her because it had to have been the moment that she really pulled herself all the way down, that there was no hope of ever coming back out. And that's why that jump scare, when it's in there at the beginning of the movie, it just feels like an out-of-place jump scare. But at the end of the movie, when you see the character playing with that box, it's, no, that moment was when she decided, I'm going to kill the love of my life because she's having success that I'm not, and now she's leaving me to start sleeping with the director.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill her. And that moment is what ruins, you know, her. It's her point of no return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, while we're talking about theories about Mulholland Drive, let's talk about Club Silencio.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a reason why a lot of people think that Mulholland Drive is adjacent to the Twin Peaks universe. And it's because of this Club Silencio scene where the club has a lot of Black Lodge vibes and also has Laura Palmer and Renette Polanski sitting in it.
Yeah.
Like, so it's very possible that this homeless man is just another Black Lodge spirit. It's wild to think that we're not told there's this interconnectivity between Lynch's projects, but it just feels like that fits still.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And the Club Silencio scene is, it gets me every time, because every time I'm convinced she's singing and then she falls over and I'm like, oh, that's right, she's not singing. Brilliant decision to use Llorando by Roy Orbison. Yeah. Take Crying by Roy Orbison, throw it in Spanish and do that. I mean, it's brilliant. But that scene is phenomenal because it's, you know, everything has been planned. And also, it is one of the most important scenes about what the theme of this movie is, which is you get out to Hollywood and you have no shot if you don't know the right people, if you're not in the right know, right? And I mean, I'm not saying that happens all the time out there, but nepotism and people getting favors and things like that, that's a legitimate thing that never goes away and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's that feeling of you're constantly like, do I actually have a chance? And this Club Silencio scene is them saying, no, you don't. It's everything is a recording. It's going to be the same people every time who are going to get the job and the role and whatever over you. Like, you're not going to get it. It has been predetermined that you will not succeed in this city. And, you know, we see how good she is at acting and we see the people saying that. And she walks in and first of all, in this movie, the three best scenes of the movie, in my opinion, all involve the music. It's and maybe the one scene is really just one scene and it's not two scenes. But when they do the 16 Reasons Why I Love You, and then it goes into the I've Told Every Little Star. I mean, the I've Told Every Little Star is the turning point of the movie, because the I've Told Every Little Star is she's successful, or she could be successful. She's very talented. We have now seen that she's very talented. She comes in, this director and her, who have been over here, they're not even close to each other. Now they're finally converging, and they bump into each other just to fly back off into the universe, right?
Yeah.
That's the turning point, because at that moment, it's like she never had a chance to impress Justin Theroux. She could have, and there's that eyes locking connection that we feel, but she never has that chance to impress him. And rather than ever getting the chance, she goes off to go with Camilla, which we kind of get in the real life version of this, where she's talking, you know, she gives up a lot of her stuff, and Camilla's bringing her along for the ride to get parts and everything, because Camilla is the successful one. So she goes off to be with Camilla rather than achieving what she really could achieve, and they go to find Diane Selwyn, who is dead, and we find out it's like the same exact situation as when she does end up killing herself in real life. But they go to find Diane Selwyn, and that to be a turning point. And then after they find Diane and they go home and everything that's happening, it gets very Persona from Ingmar Bergman with the way they're like kind of melding in, and we're the same person and whatever, and the wig, and then they go to Club Silencio. I mean, that stretch is just, it's so well done, because that's when you start saying to yourself, what is going on in this movie? And then it brilliantly, just when you're like, what? She comes walking out and she goes, Betty, where are you? And then the cowboy just shows up and says, little girl, it's time to wake up. Boom. And here we are. Now we're in reality. And here's everything we just saw for the 2 hours, the real way it actually played out, not in this dream world that Naomi Watts wishes was how it played out.
Yeah. And that recreation of the opening sequence driving down Mulholland Drive is so beautiful, because again, it's Lynch playing with our expectations of this is how things should be. We've seen it before. We know what's happening. So we think when, you know, the driver pulls over, we think he's going to pull the gun out on Betty, now Diane, and like get her to get out, and she's going to be actually Rita. But instead, we see her join up with Camilla, who is Rita, who Rita actually is, and going up to the director's house and everything. And it's such a fantastic way of using our expectations and turning them to immediately make you say, I thought I had a grasp on this movie, and now I'm not 100% sure I do.
Now I'm not 100% sure. Exactly. And all the characters that she's talking to and everything throughout that part, they all, like, everybody she's intersecting with. And I love that we get all the backstories. Well, yeah, you were great in the Sylvia North story. But why did she get the role? Why did Camilla get the role instead of Diane? Diane thinks it's because she was sleeping with the director. And Diane wasn't going to give up who she was, because Diane was in love with Camilla. And I mean, there's so many layers to the whole thing. And it all plays on itself, right? Because her going up to Mulholland Drive and coming out of the car and everything, she thinks that she's back. She might have a chance with Camilla, and she gets there, and now they're going to get engaged. And it's so like over the top, and everything is so... That's her point of no return. There's no way to come back from it. And that's why I think it's called Mulholland Drive, because at the beginning of the movie, it's where Camilla crashes, right? It's where Camilla crashes and goes down into the city and finds Diane. And in the real world, it's where Diane hits her last point of hope, and now it's gone. And now she must go to the point where she has to kill Camilla.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have the old couple.
The old couple's terrifying.
They are perhaps more terrifying than the homeless man. They are, I don't know how to feel about them. And even in our introduction, when we see them like just driving along, laughing in the back of the town car, like it is terrifying and unsettling, and you're not sure why. And then Lynch brings them back for the climax here. Mm-hmm. And it's absolute insanity.
Yeah. Oh no, the old people are the only thing scarier than the old people is the refrigerator in Requiem for a Dream. Because the old people are terrifying when they come crawling out of that box and everything. But it's her feeling like while she's about to kill herself, she's thinking back to when she first arrived in Los Angeles. And these people who will look for you up on the big screen, it's going to be great. And like those feelings of everything's going to work out. Yeah. And now as she's about to kill herself, she's thinking about that, right? Like of how foolish she was to think that was going to happen. And now she's gone past the point of no return. And the old couple's crazy. But again, everything in this movie, we've talked about it now for 30 minutes. It is very well explained considering how David Lynch normally leaves things. I feel like this is one of the most easily digestible David Lynch movies. And it doesn't feel that way the first time you watch it, but I think that's the fun of Mulholland Drive. And it honestly doesn't feel like that the second time you watch it. But again, that's the fun of Mulholland Drive. But the more you watch it, the more you pick up on, and the more enjoyable of an experience it becomes. Honestly, I wish I could kind of go back to how I felt the first time I watched it, because I wish I could get back into that mindset of having no idea what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of this like wonderful blissfulness of not knowing. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to explain. So if you haven't watched Mulholland Drive, watch Mulholland Drive just for that experience. Yeah, and might hate it. Because, and I think a lot of the hate for this film comes, and a lot of like, the reasons why people are confused by it is the way that David Lynch shoots it. Mm-hmm. Because he shoots it. If you put this movie on for someone and didn't tell them anything about it, they would think this is some amateur director making this movie.
They would. And he does it on purpose. And that's yeah, like what you have to realize. But also I think the first time you watch it, I think you're invested enough because it's like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. And I think the second time you watch it is when you have to get over that hurdle of, wait, was this actually that good? And then once you get to the end again, you're like, oh no, he knew what he was doing. And I almost feel like I had that experience this time because I haven't seen this in like 3 or 4 years now. And so for me, it really was like, wait, do I like this movie as much as I thought I liked it? Like, wait, was this just because I like David Lynch? And then once we get into like the I've told every little star and everything, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. And really the real best scene is when Naomi Watts is acting out the scene with the old mm-hmm. guy.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where it's telling you everything you're seeing isn't what you actually think you're seeing. Like there is a performance being played for you. And when Lynch, I mean, that's the first scene where Lynch really turns it on and you're like, this isn't the same movie I've been watching. Mm-hmm. And he's doing that on purpose. He's slowly getting more and more normal. And the scenes are feeling less and less, like awkward and without momentum as he gets closer and closer to waking up from the dream.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's just to think that we live in a time where we can actually just watch David Lynch projects is amazing.
Yeah. Well, I didn't watch anything else this week. So I finished The Last of Us. I thought the last episode was okay. I thought the season as a whole, like I thought it started off strong and then it just like didn't do it for me as much. I don't know if I'll watch season two. Like, I know it followed the game very well, but I think a lot of the excitement of the game is that you're playing and killing zombies and people for like 30 hours. And then the show was like, here's the new character. And you're like, oh yeah, that's that character. Can't wait to see David. And then David's gone in like 40 minutes. And you're like, oh, I get that. That's like really what happened in the game. But like in the game, he feels like he's such a bigger portion of the game. But anyway, you know, The Last of Us, I mean, I thought it was good. I don't know if I'll watch the second season, but I liked it. What was the best thing you watched this week, though?
Ooh, tough question. I watched some good movies this week. I watched three. I watched three movies that are not in our top 100 this week. I watched Midnight Cowboy, mm-hmm. Apocalypse Now, and Breathless.
Ooh, that's a doozy, man. That is a doozy.
And I think I have to go with Breathless.
I like Breathless.
I have to take that French New Wave over Apocalypse Now. And don't get me wrong, Apocalypse Now is an incredible film. I was texting you while I was watching it. It's an experience. Like it absolutely captures that feeling of a Vietnam conflict and everything. But Breathless just is such a beautiful film. Like just this beautiful French New Wave film. And it's so much style. Like Godard didn't need to put any substance into that movie, yet there's still a ton of substance in it, and it's just it's such an easy watch.
Yeah, it is it is mostly style though. Belmondo's phenomenal, and I really like Breathless. Out of those three, I'd go Apocalypse Now, then Midnight Cowboy, then Breathless. But they really are great movies. Mm-hmm. Breathless just, I mean, Breathless is all style. Midnight Cowboy is a messed up movie, though. John Voight and Dustin Hoffman in that movie are phenomenal. Like, they are phenomenal in that movie. And that is a, that's an interesting movie. That's kind of got a little Mulholland Drive to it in terms of, like, you're showing up in the big city and everything's going to be great.
Yeah, it was a good week to watch that one.
What's his name? Ratso Rizzo?
Yeah.
Love it. Love it. Yeah, Dustin Hoffman. I don't think Dustin Hoffman won the Oscar for that. He should have.
He did not.
Yeah, he didn't. John Voight won, right? Or no?
Thanks. Maybe. Now I think John Voight was nominated.
Yeah, I think maybe you're right. Maybe it didn't win. Maybe it didn't win much. It won picture, director, and writing. That was it. Yeah, actor, actress, and then Sylvia Miles was nominated, but no wins on any of those. So really, only won three Oscars for that movie. John Wayne won for True Grit. That's what it was. And Hoffman and Voight were both up for lead rather than being supporting.
Weird.
Yeah, you probably could have put Hoffman in supporting and he probably would have won. Gig Young won for They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And he's phenomenal in that. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Is great, but still, he probably would have won.
No.
Anyway, over to Casablanca from 1942, which I have at number 10. And I, you know, whenever we do this kind of thing, I mean, if you look at mine and John's list, we don't try. I mean, at least I don't. I'm not going to speak for John because I don't know what's up with John, but I don't try to be different with my list, right? Like when I make my list solely based on what movies do I like. That's why everybody wants some, or I had everybody want some. And that's why I still have a movie like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in my top 10 and Casablanca in my top 10 and things like that. The Graduate in my top 5. But then I'm also going to have Amelie, Eternal Sunshine, and American Beauty, whose letterbox ranking just tanks by the day because Kevin Spacey was in it. And like, I get it, but come on, guys, come on, give me a break. But Casablanca, when you sit down and you say, what's the greatest Hollywood movie ever made? Like, what's the greatest? It's Casablanca. Like, Citizen Kane is not better than Casablanca. And I hate to be like this, but The Godfather is not better than Casablanca. Like, Casablanca is so perfect. And I'm not saying those other movies aren't perfect, because The Godfather is absolutely perfect and Citizen Kane is perfect in a lot of ways, except for some. But Casablanca has everything you could possibly want from a movie. And it's 81 years old. And I feel like I'm watching a movie that is being put together like a new movie, even though it was made 81 years ago. The characters are phenomenal. The Rick's American Cafe might be the best setting for a movie ever. Like, ever. Like, I think about this scene when you first go into Rick's American Cafe and it jumps around between all of the characters having their conversations about the transit papers, the Nazis, the Vichy, Vichy French, whatever, however you say it, all of that stuff, all those conversations that are going on. You have Sasha talking to Yvonne, and they're like, I love you, but he pays my checks. Like, all that stuff before you even get to Rick, before you even get to Rick, that is stuff that they weren't doing back then. That is a very new school way of making film, right? Like, I think PTA loves to not focus. When we just did Boogie Nights last week, he loves to not focus on what is the focal point of your scene. He likes to bring you in with all the other characters and have something that's a through line that brings you through. It is so natural the way that this progresses that it is just, it's so new school, even though it's one of the oldest movies on my list. And then watching the movie this time, I've come to the conclusion that Rick is probably the best written character in film.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot. I mean, Michael Corleone is up there. You know, like, there's a lot of, I mean, I could keep going, but like, you know, I'm not going to sit here and just list a bunch of great characters from movies, because I'm going to leave out some of them and get frustrated. But Michael Corleone is one that just comes to mind because I just mentioned The Godfather. Mm. But Rick is so perfect in his convictions, and it's so immediately established by every single thing he does. He's so neutral. And yet he'll pop his, even though I don't stick my head out for nobody, he'll pop his head up when it's time to do the right thing. And I think that's what makes Rick so amazing, because he will let people suffer. He will let things happen bad. He will take advantage of people. We see him take advantage of Peter Lorre right at the beginning of this movie. He doesn't care about Peter Lorre. Forget you, man. I got the papers and you're getting out of here. I don't need you. But the roulette scene.
Yep.
And the scene with you think he's turning in Victor Laszlo. And it turns out he's not turning in Victor. Like, it's the best written character. Like, I just and it's crazy to me that it's been 81 years and people have not been able to figure out how to make a character that feels so natural like that. Like, there's a lot of great characters in film. Like, don't get me wrong. But I just feel like I know everything I need to know about Rick Blaine. And Rick Blaine's not even in the first 15 minutes of this movie. And the movie's an hour and 43 minutes long. And I know so much about him, but I still know everything else that's going on. I know the world so well. I know the other characters so well. I know every side character. And the craziest part is the Epsteins, they never came close again.
No. No, this is, like you said, this is a perfect movie in every sense of the word. There's a reason why it's my number one afterwards. I've watched this movie 3 or 4 times since we've made our list now. It's playing in theaters here in 2 weeks. I just watched it yesterday. I'm going to go watch it again. Are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to go watch it again in theaters. This movie is the epitome of what a movie should be. It draws you in. You are so invested in every single thing happening in this movie. It starts with this simple, like, radio-esque broadcast telling you about what Casablanca is. It's this, like, hive of villainy, essentially, right? It shows you that with the first character in Casablanca we're introduced to is the pickpocket.
Yep.
Who doesn't have a name in this movie. He's just the pickpocket.
Yeah.
And that's all he does. And it's these little things. There's the scene later on where he runs into, oh, I can't remember who he runs into in Rick's club, but he had just pickpocketed the one guy and he runs into
Carl.
He runs into Carl and Carl checks for his wallet. Like, he just knows. And it's such an attention to detail in these characters and the way these characters know each other and interact with each other. And then we're taking to Rick's American Cafe, and I don't think there's a better introduction to a character ever. No. You know exactly who he is by the way people are talking about him. You know exactly how important he is to this entire ecosystem. And the reason why Rick Blaine is, as you say, the best character written in film. AFI has him as, I think, the number 4 hero of all time. And AFI's wrong. He is the number 1 hero of all time. Well, I think he's a hero. I think there's no question.
He is, but he's not. You know, he's an anti-hero.
But that's exactly why he's number 1, in my opinion. It's because he has that contrast to him. Because AFI has, I think, Atticus Fitch as their number 1 character, as their number 1 hero, right? And I get that. Like, he's this altruistic hero fighting for those who can't fight for themselves. Rick Blaine, despite how much he wants to stay neutral, despite how much he wants to just not stick his neck out for anyone, he's still always doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes him such a better hero, because he's so much more multifaceted than these other heroes we get.
Mm-hmm.
He just has so much depth to his character, and the performance by Humphrey Bogart in this role is second to none. Like, he puts so much into this character. You feel every single emotion, all that tension and struggle Rick goes through throughout this entire film. You're sitting there feeling it with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, like you're saying, with attention to detail and everything, I think one of the things that creates that feeling is Sam constantly playing the piano, right? Because Sam is such a great character, and everybody knows, play it, Sam, play as time goes by. Everybody knows that. And I don't think people realize it's from this. And, or at least the play it, Sam, is from this. And that, him playing the entire time, kind of creates that, because it creates that rhythm to everything that's going on throughout the bar. There's such a rhythm to it all, because you have Sam's piano music. It's what is that? a diegetic music. Is that what the word is? Where it's happening actually, you're actually hearing what everybody else is hearing. And we see Rick, he's this hardened guy, he doesn't want to do whatever, and we hear all these people talking about him. But you always fought for the losing side because you are a bleeding heart, even though you don't want to admit it. Like, you're not this hard guy that you try to pretend you are. You just, he's become cynical because of everything that's happened to him in his life. And now he's sitting in Casablanca while everybody else is waiting for their papers to get out of Casablanca because it's unoccupied. And he can't go back to America. So it's a good spot for him, right? It's away from Paris. And like, we've seen this trope millions of times now where it's the guy who can't get the girl and his heart's broken and he leaves. We don't know his heart's been broken at the beginning of this. People aren't talking to him about, oh man, poor Rick. Can you believe ever since his wife died or ever since his kid died? Or, you know, there's, that's not in there. Instead, we're just seeing this hardened, cynical guy who gets the papers. He knows the arrest is coming and he lets Peter Lorre be arrested with and keeps the papers for himself. That's a great introduction to a character. And we get all those little side snippets of he never drinks with the customer and he never does this and he never does that. And as soon as Ilsa Lund walks on screen, everything about Rick changes. And we see him start to break down and the more human side of him come out. The human side was always there, but now the human side is coming out a little bit more because we're seeing what made him what he really is today. And that was Ilsa not showing up on the train platform. And I love that in 1942, they were already writing about how cliche it was that she did, that it was a man in the rain and it was a and he says it was cliche. And I love that because it was 1942. And now we've seen that a bajillion times, but they were already calling it cliche back then. But Humphrey Bogart knew, Rick Blaine knows he's a walking cliche when it comes to that. And it's like his whole persona is to push that cliche away and be wholly Rick Blaine, which for him is to be this cynical guy, because trying to do the right thing, letting his guard down, whether it be with the girl, fighting for the Ethiopians, whatever he was doing, it always worked against him. It always has led him down the wrong path. But at Rick's, everybody is somebody, right? He is at Rick's, he owns it, and he owns Casablanca because of Rick's American Cafe. Because he lets everybody in. He doesn't care if you're the Nazis or the others, the resistance. He does not care. He'll let everybody into his establishment, maybe because he has to, maybe because he wants to. He doesn't care what the reason is. His business is his business, and he now remains neutral because not being neutral has hurt him so many times. It's ruined him so many times. Now he doesn't have a choice but to be neutral. And that is so well captured. And we see the Ilsa scenes and we're like, why did she leave him? Why? Like, it's so quick. And it's, and really that backstory, I mean, all the here's looking at you kid stuff is very quick. It's very, very fast. And that reveal of he was always my husband. It's like, ah, now we're getting somewhere. This isn't melodramatic Hollywood. This is not melodramatic. This is legitimate writing, and the hand that is guiding us, it has never been more confident.
Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is, like, there's so many little things. We talked about how Sam is such an important character in this movie. There is nothing in this movie that tells you how big of a deal it is that Ilsa Lund walks into Rick's American Cafe as Sam's reaction to it. Mm-hmm. Sam knows immediately. It's like, oh, this is bad. This is trouble. And I don't know how to get out of it. And he can't. Yeah. He just goes along with it. And it's phenomenal. And the fact that, you know, like you said, he was always my husband. You don't even feel like, usually when we have those type of moments, we're supposed to feel bad in some way, right? You know, Ilsa stepping out on her husband or whatever. You don't. Because Laszlo was in a concentration camp and supposedly was dead.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, you don't feel bad about that. You almost feel sorry for Ilsa for not being able to continue this torrid romance with Rick, because it's the perfect romance. Like, that's what it comes down to, is this is the perfect encapsulation of love in film. And this is what people aspire to in love, right? Like, to get to that moment at the end of the movie where Rick is saying, like, giving up his chance of a life with Ilsa for the betterment of mankind.
Yeah.
Like, that's the true love that Hollywood aspires to. It captured in 42 and it can't do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, not to that level. And it's pretty awesome, like, when you say all of that with the true love and everything, because Ilsa at first seems like such your typical, like, femme fatale. She's up to something. But in reality, and this is where expectations, I always say, like, when you have to subvert expectations, you first have to address the expectations. And the subversion of expectations is she's so honorable. She wants to do everything the right way. And she wants things done to save herself and her husband. And when she feels that she can't save her husband, she goes to get the papers. And of course, they have their moment of, oh, I love you so much, Rick, and whatever, and blah, blah, blah. But how much of is that in the act? And how much of that is being sincere? How much of that is I just want the papers? And how much of that is I really do have feelings for you? And I think there's a bit of both in there, because she never had time to fall out of love with Rick because her husband came back. But she wasn't cheating on her husband. She didn't abandon her husband because he went off to war. She had heard he was dead. And how do you move on from that? She was moving on from that. And she couldn't tell Rick. She sends him the note and that's it. And you think, okay, that's going to be the end of the relationship. There's not going to be anything else. These characters are so well written and their motivations are so clear. And when their motivations aren't clear, we still feel like, okay, I want to know why their motivations are going this way, right? So you're willing to go along for the ride. Ilsa Lund doesn't get talked about enough as, like, one of those great heroes as well. And she's not as good as him, obviously. But she is also putting everything on the line for herself to get her husband out of there, to try to save her husband, or at least, like, you know, find some sort of happiness. And I know she's, like, she's kind of willing. She doesn't think she's selling out her husband. She thinks she's getting the transit papers. She thinks everything's going to go well. And she doesn't want, she wants everybody to leave. I mean, she wants a happy life. Mm-hmm. And ultimately she does the honorable thing and she gets on the plane with Victor Laszlo and they fly off and they get out of there. Because that's what needed to be done for the betterment of everything, so that Victor Laszlo could continue on and continue to be the necessary resistance to the terrible Nazi army. And the one thing I will say, John, and maybe it's because 1942, when they made, wrote, directed this movie, it was, we were still like, we knew Hitler was bad at this point. We had crossed over the point of like, oh, Hitler's just like an up and coming star, but we weren't at the point where we knew how bad he was yet, right? Yep. No, like, we knew he was really bad, but we didn't know he was that extreme.
We didn't know about the Holocaust until after D-Day.
Yeah, so we're talking, yeah, like mid-40s then. So
44. Like, yeah. 44 is when we found out that, like, of the severity of the concentration camps.
So that's, I think, what also helps this movie is that it was made before we knew the severity, because you had talked about it with The Pianist. You said, every time there's a Nazi, I just, like, I'm not shocked by how bad the Nazis are. Like, you can never shock me. Like, they're pushing a guy out of a wheelchair and he falls face plants and you're like, just another day of watching a Nazi.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. But with this, because we didn't know to that extreme, we see how much the people don't like the Nazis, but they do it in such a way that it doesn't feel cartoonish. And I'm not saying that the Nazi acts in these other movies are cartoonish, because I think The Pianist is harrowing. Yeah. But I do think that there's a necessity when you're making a movie now about Nazis where you have to push it to the extreme. And in this movie, really the worst thing the Nazis do in the movie is try to capture Victor Laszlo and use the police against their people, which is like kind of typical dictatorship kind of stuff. I mean, it's not like crazy. And especially during that time period, I mean, we were coming off of a time with czars and kings and what, like, we weren't like a fully democratic world as much as we are now, whether you're socially democratic or whatever, it doesn't matter. We just weren't at that point yet. So this wasn't crazy, but we see the reactions. And I think that helps this movie a lot, because it you're still happy when the Nazi gets shot at the end, whatever his name, Lasser or whatever his name is. When he gets shot at the end, you're happy about it. But you don't need him to be so extremely bad. We don't need to watch him kill people and do these horrific things for that to be satisfying.
The best part about Strasser's character is that it allows Renault's character to be that much better.
Oh yeah. Claude Rains in this is
Claude Rains is so good in this movie.
Yeah, Claude Rains is 10 out of 10.
But Strasser's character is, because the nice thing about having the Nazis here is, yeah, you know they're bad. And you expect them to be bad. And no, they're not doing like terrible things. They're still like being diplomatic about the way they're approaching everything, right? They're not arresting Laszlo for no reason or anything like that. They're being rather civil for what we know Nazis.
They're trying to plant the evidence, you know?
Yeah, exactly. They're going out of the way to make him actually be guilty of something.
Mm-hmm.
And but because of that, Strasser doesn't come off as this conniving villain by any means. He just comes off as this authority figure in opposition to mm-hmm. our heroes. And a lot of that comes to the way of like how he's welcomed to Rix at the beginning of the movie. Like our introduction to Strasser is, yeah, he's a Nazi and we don't like Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
But like we kind of have to respect their authority here because they kind of mm-hmm. are controlling a large part of the world right now.
And crazy to make that movie while the Nazis hadn't been overtaken.
Right? Like
it's crazy.
Every time I think
the Nazis still could have ended up ruling the world.
Winning. Yeah. Like to have this movie come out in 42 during the middle of World War II, it's the best World War II movie ever made because it's just like the one that was made during World War II.
Yeah.
And it captures everything. But I don't want to talk about Strasser and the Nazis. I want to talk about Renault.
Yeah,
because the character of Renault in this is so fantastic. He is built in a way where you think he's a Nazi sympathist and that he's like just working so closely with the Nazis, but he's just doing his job. His job in Casablanca to, you know, make sure people who are leaving are leaving for legitimate reasons and things like that, signing papers, getting them out there, arresting those who are committing crimes and everything. And you spend this entire movie wondering what side of the line he stands on.
But yeah, and we see him sleeping with the women to get them the papers. We see him he's doing it for sexual favors. They couldn't say that outright back in 1942, but that's what he's doing. And we know all of that. So he's corrupt. But what does he say at the one part? Like, I'm just an ordinary corrupt politician or something like that. I forget what his wording is, but it's great. And I mean, even the part where Strasser's like, find a reason to shut this place down. And they shut it down and Blaine goes, why are you shutting it down? I'm shocked to find that there's gambling going on here. And the guy comes over and goes, here you are.
Here's your winnings.
Yeah, and he takes them and he goes, thank you. Like, this movie has a humor to it too that a lot of like mm-hmm. a lot of older movies it doesn't hit. Like you can't sit down and watch a screwball comedy a lot of the times from the 30s now because they don't hit anymore because the humor is just not the same. Casablanca, it's all wit, and wit always will last. It doesn't matter as long as people still know what the words mean and you're not just using catchphrases. Everybody will always know what's going on.
Yeah, and like that's what's so great and. Oh, there's so much more to talk about this movie, and we unfortunately just don't have enough time.
Yeah.
One of the other big establishments I find with Rick's character in this and how important he is and how respected he is in Casablanca is his interactions with Ferrari and like Ferrari wanting to buy the club and wanting to buy Sam and like pay him more. And Sam's like, no, I'm happy here. I'm fine not being paid more. Like, it's all good. And like, when Rick does go finally to sell the club to Ferrari and says Sam gets 25% of the profits and Ferrari's like, I know it's 10, but I'll make it 25 for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's those moments. It's like, this is how respected this character is here.
Yeah.
And we haven't even talked for the last 5 minutes of this movie, which are but before we do have to talk about the scene where Laszlo riles up the club singing this like nationalist French song. It's the French national anthem, right? I don't actually know, but it's such a powerful scene. It's one of the most powerful scenes in all of cinema, in my opinion. Well, it just gets you going.
And I have to say, I respect, because I haven't watched Casablanca in a little while. It makes me have such more respect for what Bob Fosse did with Cabaret, because one of the big moments of Cabaret is when they sing Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
Yeah.
And it's the Nazi singing at the festival, the youthful Nazis, beautiful, great looking kid. And everybody starts singing along with him. And that's the part where Michael York says, "You still don't think that they have that much power?" You know, like, it's that moment, right? It's a turning. And that, I think, is set 3 years before, 4 years before what year this is taking place. And it makes me have so much more respect for Fosse, even though I already have so much respect for him, because I think Fosse was learning from Casablanca and doing the opposite of Casablanca, where it's firing up the crowd with a Nazi anthem rather than firing up the crowd with this anthem. But no, it's a phenomenal movie, phenomenal part, and it shows why they're so worried about Laszlo, because Laszlo does have the people on his side, and it's not a 50-50 split. The Nazis are drowned out. They can't sing over it. They can't do anything with it. So it's they're just totally gone.
It's so powerful. It's just, I spent a lot of time in this movie crying. I'm not going to lie. And it's just like, it's not even like emotional crying for like how sad or how touching the movie is. It's just for how beautiful the movie is.
Yeah. So Sidney Greenstreet, first, I just want to mention him. He's Ferrari. He is such an underrated actor. He was in the Maltese Falcon the year before with all of them. Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, they're great character actors. I freaking love those. They make me feel like I'm at home. It's a cold night in the winter, and I'm sitting by a fireplace watching their movies. So I love mentioning Sidney Greenstreet here. But this movie ended up with six quotes on the AFI Top 100 list. And I do believe, in my opinion, this is the most quotable movie of all time. Maybe second to Anchorman, because Anchorman does have milk as a bad choice and things like that. But this movie, like, if you're talking non-comedy, this is the most quotable movie of all time. And I think it's more quotable than The Godfather, because Godfather has some great ones, but this one has all-time great ones. So it has, "Here's looking at you, kid. Louie, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by. Round up the usual suspects. We'll always have Paris. And of all the gin joints of all the towns and all the world, she walks into mine." I mean, whatever. They're all amazing. Rick Blaine says four of them. The craziest part is four of those lines, or five, what is it? It's four or five. Four of those lines. Four of those six lines are said in the last 5 minutes of this movie. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, "Here's looking at you, kid" has said a whole bunch throughout the movie. So, but he does say it again in this last 5 minutes. He says, "Here's looking at you, kid. What happens to us now, we'll always have Paris." Then they don't even get the line of the problems of a few people doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the grand scheme. Like, that doesn't even get in there. And then after he goes and shoots Strasser, you finally see what side Renault is on. And that is the side of good. He's very much like Rick Blamer. When he has the opportunity, he will strike. And we get that moment where he says, "Round up the usual suspects," which is a callback to the first 5 minutes of this movie when they're rounding up the usual suspects. And then, Louis, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. There are four lines in the AFI's Top 100 quotes that happened in the last 5 minutes of this movie. It is... And I think that just speaks to how brilliant and how phenomenal this climax is, because every one of those lines is so impactful. It's giving you closure on Ilsa and Rick. It's giving you closure on Victor Laszlo is Ilsa and Rick. It's giving you closure on how Renault and Rick are going to exist together now in Casablanca after we just watched Strasser, the leader of the Nazis in Casablanca, get shot and killed. And it's giving you that callback to simpler times of "Here's looking at you, kid." Casablanca's screenplay is just, there's never going to be a movie that is going to do what Casablanca's screenplay did. I just think, like, I don't know how else this, it's just never going to be done again.
No, it's impossible. And it's funny you talk about those four lines from the AFI Top 100, because I think there's an even more powerful line in that sequence of "maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life." Like, that's one of the most impactful lines in this entire sequence. I just didn't even make the list.
Yeah. Hang on, they have the nominations. I got to find that. But again, you're talking about that, right? Like, it's so insane. Like, it is just so crazy what ones they couldn't even put on there. Mm-hmm. Like, oh man. And yeah, like that, that's the other one. I think he says that right before the Hill of Beans line. Like, yeah. It's just, it's payoff after payoff after payoff after payoff after payoff. And I know people talk about Casablanca and how great it is, but I do feel like Casablanca is the one that gets glossed over, right? Like when I sit down, I'm like, what more can we say about The Godfather? What more can we say about Space Odyssey, which we're going to say a lot about it next week. But like there's certain movies where you say, what more can we say about this movie that hasn't already been said? I think, unfortunately, Casablanca gets lumped into that. It's a black and white old Hollywood movie that's just like this schmaltzy romance. That's not what this movie is. No. There are so many layers to this movie. This is one of the most layered films ever made. And it's just, it does, like, it gets that credit from movie buffs and people who like love cinema and things like that. I think so many people know what Casablanca is, but they don't truly know what Casablanca is, because I think it comes up a lot, but it's not as watched as The Godfather. And maybe it's not as accessible as The Godfather. I'll agree with that. But it is. And people just don't realize how much it is, because Citizen Kane is not as accessible as Casablanca. No. Casablanca is, should be viewed by more people than actually sit down and watch it. And I'm talking in like the general population.
And I think it's one of those things where people like you and I can help with that, because we can show it to people, because I have friends I have shown this movie to, and they're like, okay, John, you're gonna make us watch this 1942 black and white movie. Okay, how good can it be? And then they'll be like, oh wait, that's really good. And I'm like, yeah, this movie, it deserves to be watched, and there's a reason why it is always talked of amongst like the best American films ever made, because it just is.
Denying it. And I think about like the information dump at the beginning. That was such a risky move. That was such a risky move, because back in the day, audiences didn't have like, what are you talking? Like all of that information, but it sets the mood. These people are stuck here and they're on the run from something and they're trying to get somewhere. But our main character isn't. Our main character just kind of lets it happen. But that's what the setup is great. And we know if things go wrong, you get killed. We see it happen in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
There's
just, it's such a different movie than what people think it's going to be, because they think it's just going to be a romance about Ilsa and Rick. And that's not, they're barely, yes, they're romantically involved, but most of the movie isn't them talking to each other. There's very few scenes of them actually talking to you. It's the end. It's the scene where she goes to get the papers. It's when they're actually in Paris. And it's the first scene when she comes into the bar. Those are the only, there's only, I think, four scenes where they actually have the conversations.
Yeah.
And then when she tries to come in when he's drunk and he kind of kicks her out. But
yeah, there's also the scene in the alley when she's looking at the lady.
Yeah, so there's quite a few, but it's not to the extreme. It's not like a Dr. Zhivago where it's like that is the through line of the movie.
Yeah, no, it's just enough, in all honesty. Yeah. It's enough for you to realize how important this relationship is to the two of them and why both of them are wanting to fight so hard through it.
Yeah, I agree. Anything else, or just what? I'll watch this again soon.
Go watch it again soon, everyone. It's playing in theaters in Canada in 2 weeks, so I don't know if it is down there in the States too, but
I don't think so. Maybe
look out for it, because it's playing here and I can't wait to see it on the big screen.
If it is, wait, AMC, let's see. If it's playing in theaters, man, I will absolutely 100% go see it. March 5th. Oh, it played, but it wasn't playing anywhere near me.
Okay.
There goes that. Anyway, next week we go to number 9. We're in single digits. How insane is that? We're talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey from 1968, which is John's number 9, and my number 9, which is Lost in Translation from 2003, the Sofia Coppola movie. So we'll be talking about both of those. John, we didn't do this last time, so we might as well do it this time. Let's go through 20 to 11, because we didn't do it last time, and normally we always end with that. So I'll start with mine. My number 20 was Good Will Hunting, 19 was Pulp Fiction, 18 was Wild Tales, 17 was The Godfather, 16 was Cinema Paradiso, 15 Everybody Wants Them, 14 Chinatown, 13, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. 12, Psycho. 11, Boogie Nights. John, do you have that in front of you? Because I totally forgot.
I do have it in front of me, actually.
Good.
My number 20 was End of Evangelion. 19 was No Country for Old Men. 18, Reservoir Dogs. 17, the most embarrassing one on my list, Casablanca. 16, Evil Dead 2. 15 Her, 14 Near, 13 Fargo, 12 Baby Driver, 11 The Road.
Yes. So we just did number 10 tonight. We're going to be doing number 9 next week. Thank you all for listening. We're only a couple weeks away from being done, and we do have a plan for what we're going to do next. So tune in for that. We already have it ready to go. So can't wait to get started on that one. You're never going to stop hearing from us about movies, and we hope you're enjoying it. See you next week.